digital radio across the UK and online. This is Share Radio. This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, giving you 100% security for your savings.
A very warm welcome to This Is Money and Share Radio podcast in partnership with NS&I. I'm Georgie Frost here with you on DAB across the country, online and through the Share Radio mobile app. Every weekday from 9 until midday, sharing ideas about money. I'm joined in the studio today by editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce from the financial website of the year to talk through some of their stories they've been investigating over the last 7 days. And on the agenda today, banks could be forced to cap monthly overdraft fees and to give us more information about switching to better deals. But do the proposals by the competition watchdog go far enough to break the dominance of the big four?
Our entire focus is what's in it for the customers. At the moment, the way banking works, the big banks don't have to work hard enough for their customers.
We investigate the dark art of mortgage affordability calculators. There's a huge £200,000 gap between what lenders say you can borrow, and it could be pushing unwary first-time buyers into smaller properties or into different areas. Sticking with property, Simon takes a look at the impact on house prices after landlords rushed in to beat the stamp duty hike.
Frankly, people buying a home to let should not be squeezing out families who can't afford a home to buy.
Was the rush all a false economy? Now, do you struggle to get your head around all the pension changes? Do you understand charges, fees, how to make the most of your retirement savings? If the answer is no, then you're in very good company.
I found it's especially hard to get my head around all the changes there have been. It's really confusing, a lot of the stuff there. And obviously, part of my job is to be on top of all of this.
Well, that's Share Radio senior analyst Ed Boucher, the Bank of England's chief economist, also admitting they're so complex, even he can't make the remotest sense of them. So what hope do we have? Also this week, we got the latest job figures.
There are various signs that you can see that things are beginning to start to level off. A bit of concerning, but still got record levels of employment. So it's not all bad news, but it's worrying about what might be happening in the future.
Let me take a look at what are Britain's most in-demand jobs. Is it time for perhaps a new career in teaching or engineering? Britain gets more caffeinated. Why even pubs are getting in on the takeaway coffee boom. And we explore how the 21st century has transformed the British high street. So I want to know, please, what are the shops of your youth? A very good morning, Simon. A very good morning, Lee.
Hello, Georgie.
Simon, starting with you, please, shops of your youth.
The shops where I spent much of my youth and my teenage years were shops that sold music. So basically, in latter times, HMV, when I was at university in Leeds, I used to go into Leeds to the big HMV in the centre where they had a really good record selection, and I'd basically buy records once a week and blow all the money that I should have been spending on living on, and then I'd spend my overdraft and things like that. Mm-hmm. But before that, R Price. Also, there was a couple of good independent ones as well. There was one in the town where I lived in Harpenden called, I think it was called Classical Rock, was the name of the shop. And they used to sell records, and they do like a bargain basement
of
record
classical
thing.
Classical Rock?
No. Wow. All kinds of records. But they'd get singles, and basically once they were a bit out of date or if they hadn't sold so well, they'd discount them down to 50p. So I bought a huge amount of 12-inch like singles for 50p. And Boxer Records in St Albans then, that was a dance music shop. We used to spend a lot of money and time in there when we probably should have been at school.
Where are those records now? Do you know?
Well, some of them are in my flat, but I can't fit all of them in my flat, so some of them are in my mum's house.
Classic.
Yeah, I was going to say, me too. Yeah, absolutely. We've also got R Price, Virgin Megastore, Zavvi here as well.
Zavvi,
yeah, remember that. Lee, for you?
The one that really sticks out from quite young childhood is C&A. I remember being dragged around C&A for hours on end. Like, I can remember the carpet, horrible 80s sort of grey swirly carpet. I used to scream when my mum took me in there. I used to hate it.
For me, it was Athena. Do you remember Athena? With the posters. Woolworths, of course, obviously. Borders. I loved it so much I even worked there and spent most of my pay on books. And Safeway. I don't know what it says about me that shops of my youth revolve around a large supermarket.
I've got another good one that I just remembered. In St Albans, when I was at school, there was a shop called Clark's, and it was a motorcycle shop. But basically, the guy who ran it also used to run a little skate shop inside of it, so sold skateboards and T-shirts and wheels and trucks and everything. That was our haunt, basically. We'd go down there every lunchtime, and he was great. He would basically, like, he would let kids hang around there, just basically looking at the skateboards. You'd come in then eventually convince your parents to spend some money. That guy did so much to support skateboarding in St Albans, and he was basically like a middle-aged guy who ran a motorcycle shop. So fair play to him. Mr.
Those,
Clark, you're a legend.
Happier memories
days,
from
yeah.
Simon there.
Here at Share Radio, we have been debating the Brexit referendum, bringing you the latest views from the world of business, finance and politics.
You'll find people who want to leave who say, I don't know anyone who wants to stay. And you'll find people who want to stay who say, I don't know anyone who wants to leave. So how it feels to you is imperfect.
We've curated all our Brexit interviews and put them in one place
to help you make an informed decision on the 23rd of June.
Just go to audioboom.com
and type in Brexit special on Share Radio. Do indeed. I'm Georgie Frost. You're listening to Share Radio, the team from This Is Money, the award-winning finance website. Back in the studio with me for our weekly catch-up, joined today by editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce in partnership with NS&I. And coming up, pension confusion, dark arts and mortgages and caffeinated Britain. But first, £5 million, about 3 years and 400 odd pages later. A competition review into the retail banking sector was released this week. The aim? Well, to probe the dominance of the big four banks, who together hold over 70% of active personal accounts. What proposals were put forward? Break up, perhaps, of the bank, an end to free and credit accounts that mask the true cost of banking? No. Plans could see banks capping monthly unarranged overdraft charges and warning customers before they go over their limit. Now, the Competition and Markets Authority said this and other measures could save us £1 billion over 5 years. There will also be a push for better online tools so we can make more informed choices. But consumer groups, challenger banks and analysts say the proposals do not go far enough. Alistair Smith from the CMA says it's about getting a fair deal.
Our entire focus is what's in it for the customers. At the moment, the way banking works, the big banks don't have to work hard enough for their customers. We want to put new tools into the hands of customers so that the banks will have to work much harder for them and give them a much better deal than they get at the moment. We looked very hard at the idea of breaking up the banks. But it's not the size of the banks that's the problem. The real problem is that customers don't get clear information about banking products, about what they cost them. So customers don't have the information that they need to shop around. And frankly, having 8 banks or 9 banks that don't have to work hard for the customers is no better than having 4 or 5 banks that don't have to work hard for the customers. So we want to tackle the real problem, not get involved in really expensive changes that wouldn't necessarily have much effect on the market. We're not interested in protecting the banks. We're not interested in bashing the banks for their own sake. All we're interested in is getting a good deal for customers, especially customers who at the moment often have to pay far too much in charges for unarranged overdraft. Among the whole package of measures that we're proposing today are a number of measures which are aimed to tackle the problem of overdraft charges, requiring banks to announce what's the maximum they're going to charge for overdrafts, and also giving customers warnings, prompt warnings, when they're liable to go into overdraft and start incurring charges. But our entire focus is on making life better for customers.
Well, that was Alistair Smith from the CMA there. Tony Cross, market analyst at Trustnet Direct, thinks the banks, well, didn't do too badly out of the report.
This ruling could have been an awful lot more toxic for the banks, really. They say it's going to save customers £1 billion over 5 years. So that might sound like a lot of money, but when the banks are making $1.2 billion a year from these fees, it's basically a cap on unauthorised overdraft fees, they're making $1.2 billion a year as it stands. So it's going to be a drop in the ocean in terms of impact on the banks. And I guess the other thing is banks have a duty to manage the risk here. And, you know, the big thing here is a lot of people need to be more responsible with credit. And I suspect there'll be a direction from the banks to see that through and have people, you know, less likely to trigger these unauthorized limits. So, no, it's you know, obviously current accounts need to be paid for. Bigger conversation to be had about, you know, should free current accounts be allowed at all? But you know, for the time being, that's going to continue. No change there.
That was Tony Cross there speaking to Share Radio. Well, the CMA has proposed making it easier to move accounts by forcing banks to introduce technology so their customers' accounts history can be shared easily with rivals, which means we could soon have every detail of our spending shared with other banks and price comparison sites. Privacy campaigners are quite naturally concerned. Personal finance expert Joe Faith spoke to me about this on our 9:30 news review.
Banks will have to share your information about your account so that you are directed to a better deal or a better account or a better rate automatically. And obviously the big thing, the big concern is privacy concerns, which are understandable. Obviously they've said that more needs to, the Competition and Markets Authority have said more needs to be done, especially with overdrafts and potentially capping fees on overdrafts. Mm. And this seems to be an extension of that, of making sure that people are in accounts that aren't suitable for them, that they are moved out of them. This would be regulation to allow that to happen. And, you know, I come on this show and talk about how important switching is all the time, that you can get a better deal if you switch on, you go on comparison sites and things like that. And this, for me, I think this is a good idea. I mean, the important point that I read in the story is that you would have to sign up to allow your bank or building society to share information. So if this isn't something that you'd want, then you wouldn't need
for now.
To. For now.
But I'm wondering as well, if there's all this sort of data around and they're sharing it, is there a danger, sort of ironically, of collusion?
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah, probably. There probably isn't.
Being that this is a Competition Markets Authority measure or proposal. Oh, I'm so cynical, aren't I? So, Lee, I'm going to come to you first. Why was this investigation started by the Competition and Markets Authority?
In a nutshell, it was to see if the banking competition is working in the best interest of customers. I mean, that is it in an absolute nutshell.
Why would they think it's not?
Oh, because you look at how many people bank with the same sort of big five or six banks, and it is a large proportion of people in Britain. Mm. You know, and people, you know, not many people like to switch their current account because they think it's going to be very difficult. I think, you know, all your direct debits are set up on one thing, your wages are paid in. It might be a little bit complex to switch it all over. So that's why a lot of people don't switch. Now, interestingly, about a month or so ago, there were switching figures that suggested switching, current account switching, is actually at its highest level, you know, ever. So more people are now willing to switch. What this report really is, in my opinion, is just 405 pages of pretty much hot air. It's all things that have probably been mentioned and said before. So banks could be forced to cap monthly overdraft fees. I mean, they could be.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not even like they've got to be.
And this is a proposal, though, we should say. The final report will be in August.
Yeah, so that's when the final things will come, you know, come to fruition, and we'll get the final, you know, answers to all this. But it is, it just feels like there's been a bit of a golden opportunity to really reform things and make things better. And this whole idea of sharing your information, it feels like the start of Big Brother banking, doesn't it, really? I mean, I don't want other banks to see what my information is. And a couple of years ago, the government launched My Data, which I've sung the praises of that. I mean, it's a very good service. So if you're, you know, whatever bank you're with, you should be able to download 12 months worth of statements, and then it crunches the figures and it will show you which current account would probably fit you best for your spending patterns, you know, switching incentives, and over the next 12 months, you know, which current account would be the best fit for you. I used it last summer, and I switched. I was one of the people that have never switched bank account. You know, I'd had the same bank account for 15 years, and I used it, and the bank that I wanted to switch to anyway came up trumps, and I thought, I'm just going to do it, and press the button. It couldn't have been simpler. You know, I've had no problems. The account was closed down. I'm no longer getting stung by overdraft fees or any of those kind of fees. I've got £100 for switching, and I'm a much better, you know, banking customer. So that service in itself was pretty successful. I just don't see where else these changes are coming from.
Lee, you said there that there was a golden opportunity for reform was missed. I'm going to read to you Alex Neil, Director of Policy and Campaigns at Which. After 18 months, this inquiry achieved little more than to propose basic information measures that the big banks should have introduced years ago. Steps to stimulate switching are welcome, but the chance to deliver better banking for all consumers has been missed. The ball is now firmly in the Financial Conduct Authority's court. Their first task will be to test these proposals to ensure they work for consumers. But they must also go further than better information to tackle the unfair punitive charges faced by unauthorised overdraft users, some of whom are hit with fees far in excess of payday loans. Only when the regulator addresses these unfair charges and holds the banks to account for poor customer service will we see the shake-up in banking that is so desperately needed. Simon, do you agree?
Yeah, I do, actually. But firstly, what I would say about people switching bank accounts is that the sort of idea of opening up your data to people so that you can see which bank account is best for you is to do with a lot of this sort of open banking, open source banking stuff. And it's the fintech solution to these problems.
Fintech.
Financial technology solution that's trying to be pushed towards these problems. Now, I think it's a good idea. I think the My Data thing is a good idea. But also, you know, things like our roundups where we have the five of the best current accounts. We look at five different current accounts and say, these are the ones that we think stand out, right? But what I would say is that at the moment, you could get free money for switching your bank account. You could get an interest rate on your balance that far outstrips anything that you will get in a savings account. This is even more beneficial now because of the changes to the way savings interest is taxed. So basically, you don't need to be worrying about the ISA thing to get tax-free interest because your first £1,000 of that is tax-free. Mm-hmm. And yet, still, only a small, savvy minority of people switch banks. Do we really think that basically allowing people to sit there and download a spreadsheet and then plug it into something is going to be a greater incentive to move their money and move their bank than the fact that someone will actually give them a sizable sum of free money, i.e. £100, or offer them an interest rate that massively beats the savings account, i.e. 5% rather than 1%. I'm just not so sure that that's actually the truth. Now, so some of this gets traced back by critics to the fact that we have free banking in this country, or the illusion of free banking. Yeah. And what that is that basically you don't pay for your bank account, and the way that your bank account gets paid for is by some people being overcharged when they go into something called an unauthorised overdraft. Now, cast your mind back 10 years. We were fighting against these things, unauthorised overdrafts, mm-hmm. and that's because, basically, this was a massive racket on the part of the banks, OK? This was like PPI. This was banks systematically ripping off their customers. And the way that they did it is you had your bank balance, then you had your overdraft, and then you had this thing called your unauthorised overdraft. So somehow you could go to the end of your overdraft,
yeah.
and yet they'd then lend you more money that you shouldn't be able to have because you've already got your balance, your overdraft, the point where that agreement stops, but they'll still give you more money. And then what they do is hit you with massive charges for doing that. So they might charge you at one point, it was £39 a time. So you get a £39 fine for going into that unauthorised overdraft, and then you get charged a sky-high interest rate on it. And
they were making payday loans, we were just saying.
Billions of pounds a year on this. And then it emerged, campaigners saying that actually these were unfair and you could challenge them under the unfair terms and contracts rules. And people started claiming their money back from the banks in the courts. And the banks basically, sometimes they'd turn up and sometimes they wouldn't turn up. Sometimes they'd just give you your money back. So we explained how people could do this because what we said was that, yes, our readers liked free banking. I like free banking. I don't want to pay for my current account. But I don't think that you should... That should be at the expense of people who are less financially savvy being hit with unfair charges. And basically, the whole thing was a massive racket. And people successfully reclaimed a lot of money from the banks. We had millions of people read our guide to how to do it, and we helped them do so. But then the banks were dishing out so much cash, it had become such an issue that there was essentially a test case brought in court by the OFT. Initially, the customer won. Then the banks won on appeal and the time was called on the bank charges reclaim thing. And the banks have kind of sharpened up their act a little bit since then. These charges are nowhere near as bad as they used to be, but the CMA says that they're still raking in £1.2 billion a year from basically lending people money that they shouldn't be allowed to have. And so now we have this awkward situation.
So that's one aspect to it, though. Everybody talking here, I was reading out, the missing of a golden opportunity to break up the dominance of the big four, Lloyds Banking Group, I should say, Royal Bank of Scotland, HSBC and Barclays. What would you have liked to have seen in this? What could have worked? What could have been proposed?
So I'm going to say something that's probably quite unpopular in the sense of the competition scenario, but I'm really not sure whether there's anything that the watchdog can do. Mm-hmm. It's up to people. It's their personal responsibility. If you do not like the fact that the banking world is dominated by these big four banks and you do not like these banks, and the reason why you don't like banks is because you think that they crashed the global economy, then also think about the fact about how these banks spent years ripping people off on PPI and bank charges, move, jump ship, go to a smaller bank. You have to take personal responsibility for that.
But just because you may not dislike something doesn't mean that a sort of monopoly situation is OK, surely?
No, it doesn't. But the banks will give you free money to move your account. It's like, what more could they possibly do? I think it's an imperfect scenario, and it is an oligopoly. It is basically an oligopoly. Some of it gets thrown back at this free banking. So it said that if we had to pay for our bank accounts, then the banks would compete on price and customers would have a reason to go, hey, look, I'm actually paying that person money. I'm going to think about that. So some people have even said maybe free banking should be banned. I'm not sure that I agree with that, because one of the other reasons beyond the charges why your bank offers you free banking is because your current account is the best marketing tool that a bank has, and it's the way that they try and sell you all kinds of other products. So maybe there's a problem with that as well. I think this will change, though. I think we're going to see there's a lot of new banks coming through, a lot of small banks coming through. I think that this will change, and I think that, I've said it before, I think in 5 years' time, the retail banking landscape will look very, very different to how it does now.
The final word with you.
As I say, there's a stat here. It says 60% of customers stick with the same bank account for more than a decade. It might just be the case that people are relatively happy with their bank. Mm. You know, and as Simon says, I'm not actually 100% sure what can be done that's not, you know, here's £100 to switch. That's a pretty big incentive if you're not enjoying your current account and it's not doing what you want it to do. It's so easy to switch now. So
it's not only that there's £100 to switch. So I bank with First Direct, and I've banked with First Direct for some time. And the reason why I bank with First Direct is I think they're really good.
Yeah.
And their customer service is really good. But when I moved to them, they paid me £100. You can move to the bank that regularly gets rated for the best customer service, and they'll pay you £100.
So do it, people. Is that what you're saying?
Do it. Or choose another one. Other banks exist. But think about it. Do think
this
about
it. This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NSI.com. Helping you keep on top of your savings whenever, wherever.
Right, from banks to buying a home. Very interesting article on your website. Now, we all know how notoriously difficult it is, particularly at the moment, particularly for first-time buyers. We've gone over on this show in some detail the housing crisis, lack of supply, blaming nasty buy-to-let landlords, foreign investors. So if you've managed to get over all those hurdles, you've saved a deposit, you're ready to hit the market, hold your horses. You're now being warned of something more sinister that could stand in the way of you and your dream home. The dark art of mortgage affordability. So when looking for a mortgage provider, you'll probably use an online calculator to see how much you can borrow. So what are those? Here's Share Radio's Ed Bowsher.
So these calculators help you figure out how big a mortgage you can afford to take out. You can find them all over the web. The Money Advice Service has one. Money Saving Expert has one. Lots of other sites have them too. So you'll type in how much is your income, how much your partner's income is if you have a partner. They'll probably ask for information about some of your other outgoings, maybe if you have any other savings. And then they say, well, you can afford a £200,000 mortgage, and this is what your monthly payment would be right now if the mortgage was, say, 1% or 2% or whatever it may be.
There is also, of course, one on This Is Money. But investigation by your good self has found that unwary first-time buyers could be pushed needlessly into smaller properties or different areas because these calculators are varying so much from lender to lender, by as much as £200,000 between the most and the least generous indicative maximum loan amounts. Again, highlighting the need, of course, to shop around, But why the difference in the first place? Lee, I'm going to come to you. Tell us a little bit more about this, if you would.
So our reporter, Laura, did an investigation into mortgage affordability and basically set out some guidelines. So it was based on a couple being 30, they had a joint income of £75,000, had a deposit of £25,000, wanted the mortgage over 30 years, and were going to buy a property in the southwest. So this is our fictional couple. What she did is crunch the figures on a number of lenders' own mortgage calculators to see how much they were willing to lend on a property. And the discrepancy is absolutely massive between HSBC at the bottom of the pile that would only lend, £225,000, and Yorkshire Building Society, £411,000. So that's a big discrepancy.
We should point out these calculators are only a guide, right?
They're only
a
guide.
That's still impacting or influencing where people are looking. And
it's true. And it probably highlights that, you know, a couple of things. And one of those things is to probably use an independent calculator to see how it fares to lenders that you might be looking at. Mm-hmm. It might also indicate that it's worth potentially speaking to a broker who can probably tell you where the best deals are and, you know, how, you know, which one fits you best. But interestingly, it kind of shows more, it highlights more the different risk, I guess, that different lenders are willing to have, sort of give. Yeah. And, you know, HSBC, based on the figures that we put into its calculator, only willing to lend on a loan to income multiple of 3, whereas Yorkshire Building Society is 5.49. So that's quite big difference.
Is it all down to risk, Simon? Why this huge variation?
Yeah, some of it is. So I think that it does reflect lenders' appetite for risk and what size mortgages they want to give. Maybe reflects their appetite for certain types of customer. We don't know how these things, what the exact algorithm and stuff working behind these is. But the thing that I would say is that there is an issue here in that these are presented as they're presented as a guide, but they're quite detailed. They are presented as quite a definitive guide. But actually, really, it's only when you speak to the mortgage lender and you go through the process of the mortgage interview that you will actually find out how much you can borrow. As Lee said, the advantage of going to a broker nowadays is that basically that broker, you only have to do that interview once, and then they'll look at the whole panel of lenders and they'll tell you roughly what they think you could borrow and where they think you'll find the best deal. But I would still look around yourself at the rates and I would question what the broker says to you. If the broker says to you, take a 2-year fix, ask them why they're not recommending a 5-year fix, because it might be that they just want your business in 2 years' time. But with these calculators, the flip side of this, you could say HSBC is doing you a favour. You could say that HSBC saying to only borrow 3 times your income is prudent. And that was what I said to Laura after she'd done the investigation. I was like, well, you could say that Yorkshire is actually wrong and HSBC is right. But what you could find is people who aren't particularly savvy about this. Lots of people who are first-time buyers, they don't know so much. Mm. You go online, you see an advert for HSBC, which has some of the best mortgage rates around. You go on, look at their calculator, and that says to you how much you can borrow. Now, it might be that you might not be best off right at the top of the pile with Yorkshire Building Society borrowing all the money they'll give you, but maybe you'd be better off about halfway down. So I think that there is an issue surrounding these calculators, and it comes down to this whole affordability thing that's been brought in, and no one really knows how affordability works because all the banks and building societies do it slightly differently.
Well, one mortgage broker you spoke to didn't want to tell you who they were, said the calculators proved the mortgage market review, which ushered in a wave of new affordability rules to make lenders act more responsibly, Lee, were a joke.
I love the fact that that is a little bit of an anonymous quote there, isn't it? It's a bit of a joke. I mean, that's their opinion, and you can kind of see where they're coming from when you're looking at the discrepancies highlighted on these calculators. And the other thing that's worth mentioning as well with these calculators is everyone's circumstances are different. So you might be a couple, but you might have children. So, you know, the research showed that, you know, actually, if you factored in that you've got children, some lenders all of a sudden are going to sort of really pull back on how much they're willing to lend you because you're more of a risk, because you've got more outgoings. So they go, well, actually, you know, we'll only lend you this amount of money. The one thing I would say in the whole thing about HSBC and it being quite, you know, seems stingy, loan to income of 3, is that it does offer now a one-day mortgage service. So you can go, if you can get an appointment, you can go into branch, you can speak to a mortgage advisor, and they could, in theory, issue a mortgage on the same day, which I think is quite a good service, because sometimes there is a lot of waiting around, you know, a lot of messing around. And actually, I've got a friend that used it a couple of weeks back, and he was full of praise for it. Said he went in, you know, absolutely filled in all the paperwork, told him in black and white the maximum he could borrow. You know, this is, you know, good service, in my opinion.
So, Simon, mortgage calculators are simply a marketing gimmick, according to Simon Collins, a mortgage expert at broker John Charcoal. You have a poll, do you not, on your website. Have your readers been using these marketing gimmicks when they've bought or applied for a home loan?
Well, so I do think that they definitely are a bit of a marketing gimmick. I would say that. I don't think they are entirely a marketing gimmick, however. I do think that they do provide a useful guide and they will reflect the lender. But our readers have said, did you find mortgage calculators useful when applying for a home loan? Yes, 46%. No, 54%.
Well, there you go. We're going to stick with the property theme, if that's all right. I did mention a little bit earlier, buy to let, something that you have been looking at particularly this week, Simon. Let's just step back in time. I won't get you to do your little sound effect. To November 2015, when the Chancellor introduced those changes to stamp duty.
More and more homes are being bought as buy to lets or second homes. Many of them are cash purchases that aren't affected by the restrictions I introduced in the budget on mortgage interest relief. And many of them are bought by those who aren't resident in this country. Yeah. Frankly, people buying a home to let should not be squeezing out families who can't afford a home to buy. So I am introducing new rates of stamp duty that will be 3% higher on the purchase of additional properties like buy-to-lets and second homes.
Another sound effect needed. Fast forward to March, the month before the changes due to come in. Landlords snapping up three times more homes to beat the hike, up 142% compared to earlier in the year. A staggering £7.1 billion was borrowed between February and March. This is all according to data from the Council of Mortgage Lenders. But was the rush a false economy? And what now for house prices? Asked Simon Lambert. Simon, answer your own question. What were you looking at here specifically?
So we got some statistics out this week that really laid bare the buy-to-let stampede that we've seen over the first 3 months of this year, and particularly in March, as landlords rushed to beat the stamp duty hike that was coming in. And I think that we would be safe in saying that the buy-to-let market went absolutely bananas. Mm-hmm. There are many times when, as journalists, we get criticised for using the word rocket in stories and in headlines. However, one look at this chart and you will realise that on this occasion, the word rocket and rocketed is entirely justified. Mm-hmm. Something that led to the comment from our news editor, John Hopkins, of, well, we know what happens to rockets, don't we? implying that they come back down to Earth. Mm-hmm. But this was astonishing. Like, there was so much activity in the buy-to-let purchase mortgages, basically people rushing, getting these mortgages to buy-to-let, that it actually took the number that were being issued in the first quarter of the year, the first 3 months of the year, back up to pre-financial crisis levels of 2007. And bear in mind that those levels were abnormally high. It also, I suspect, was something of a false economy. Now, it's difficult to prove this because they don't have the enough data for you to do so. But basically, in the first 3 months of the year, there were 48,800 buy-to-let purchase mortgages worth $7.2 billion. That works out at an average of $147,540. For the same period in 2015, there were 26,800 buy-to-let purchase mortgages worth $3.3 billion, an average of $123,134. So basically, buy-to-let property investors borrowed an extra £24,000 on average between January and March. That's 20% up on a year before. But house prices, if you look at the ONS figures, are only up 9%. So that says to me that some of these people in this rush probably overpaid. Question is, what happens now? We've basically, I would argue that a lot of that stuff has pulled forward buy-to-let purchases from the rest of the year. Mm-hmm. Now, they only make up a relatively small part of the market. It's 15% of the mortgage market. And maybe that undercooks it because, as George Osborne said, there's a lot of cash purchases here. But if they've all been pulled forward, and maybe not all of them, but if the bulk of them have been pulled forward, then they're not going to be in the rest of the year. There's going to be less activity in the rest of the year. Are prices going to slip back now? Are you going to be in a better position if you're buying in 3 months' time than you would have been if you were buying a month ago.
Regardless of the extra for the stamp duty.
Regardless of the extra.
Right?
I don't know. It's going to be really interesting to see. We've asked our readers, will the buy-to-let crackdown cause house prices to fall? And we've got a 53% yes and a 47% no. So it's very divided.
Lee, what's your instinct? Say, Simon asked there, it'll be interesting to see what happens next. What do you reckon?
Well, first I've got to say, this is some seriously good number crunching from Simon. Seriously, seriously good number crunching. And that graph has been imprinted in my brain this week. I've been going to sleep thinking of that graph. It is an unbelievable graph. I actually think now, there's got to be a bit of a cooling period between now and the end of the year. I mean, it's been the level of buy to let. I mean, no wonder, you know, there's some worries around it. But of course, the stamp duty changes have heavily skewed of what's going on. And what's going to happen to us, you know, the rest of the year of house prices? It's just impossible to say. But we've also got the EU referendum next month. There's been talk that, you know, that could disrupt house prices for a time. But it's drawing ever, ever closer. And it's still house prices seem to be going up. I crunched some figures this week from the ONS. And you know, let's take London for an example. Between February and March, the average property price in London went up £30,000 in 1 month.
Wow.
It's almost £1,000 a day, basically, property prices went up in London. And you can't tell me that wasn't, you know, largely driven by buy-to-let, even though they are, you know, a much smaller portion of the market than residential buyers. But there's got to be a little bit of a downturn. I don't necessarily want that to happen. I don't necessarily think that's going to be a good thing. I think it's got to be a quieter to the end of the year. That's my hunch. And I reckon house prices will probably remain relatively flat.
OK, if you can't get your head around that, what about pensions? Do you struggle to get your head around all the changes that have come in? Do you understand the charges, the fees? Do you know how to make the most of your retirement savings? If you don't, you are in very good company. The Bank of England's chief economist, no less, earlier this week says pensions were so complex, even he can't make the remotest sense of them. Andy Haldane said ordinary workers have no chance of making informed decisions about their plans when experts have no clue either. And this is harming our efforts to save enough for their older age. Here's Share Radio senior analyst Ed Bowsher again.
First thing I say, well done to Andy Haldane for saying this and admitting that he's struggling, and I have a lot of sympathy with him. I found it especially hard to get my head around all the changes there have been since the pension freedoms come in. It's really confusing, a lot of the stuff there, and obviously part of my job is to be on top of all of this. So, yeah, I think it's really hard for ordinary people to understand what's going on and to make the best decisions. If you are struggling to get on top of this all, one option is to contact something called TPAS, or the Pensions Advisory Service. Just stick that into Google, the Pensions Advisory Service. They've got good information online, but you can also have telephone conversations, and they could give you some good pointers to get more information. But I think also, do think seriously about paying for an advisor. These days, if you want to see an advisor, you have to pay an upfront fee, and it can seem like a scarily large amount of money, but it may well be worth doing. And also remember, if you've got a workplace scheme and you've got trade unions in your workplace, they may also be able to help you give you information. And your employer may also be willing to help as well. Wherever you can get advice or information, take it.
So, Simon, even the Bank of England's chief economist says pensions are so complex he can't make the remotest sense of them.
I think that there's a bit of dramatic effect in Andy Haldane's speech there.
Okay,
and I think that he maybe should have qualified that a little bit more. If I was him, I would have done. So I think that pensions themselves, don't think there's that much that's complicated for him to understand. Basically, there's two types of pension. You have an old-fashioned defined benefit pension, which is with your work, where your employer said that they would give you a certain amount of money in retirement for every year that you worked for them and you were part of the pension. And it's their responsibility to do that. Mm-hmm. They've defined the benefit they're going to give you. Then there's the new-fashioned defined contribution scheme, where you pay some money in, your employer pays some money in, it goes into an investment pot, you build that up over the years. When you retire, you use that investment pot to buy you an income in retirement, either by keeping it invested and drawing on the money, or buying a product called an annuity, which provides you with an income for life. Now, there is some complication around how you invest your pension, but most of the work schemes and personal pension schemes that you get will help you make that decision and put you into possibly the best thing that you can have, which is just the broadest possible global tracker fund. However, on top of this pension system, the other thing to mention is tax relief. You get tax relief on your pension. So all but the highest earners basically effectively can save into their pension out of pre-tax income. The way that works is you pay money into your pension and you get an uplift on it that takes you back to what it would have been if you hadn't paid tax. Basic rate, that's automatic. For most people who pay 40% tax, you have to reclaim some of it through a tax return. It's as simple as that.
OK, all very straightforward. What was Andy Haldane then talking
right,
about?
Right, so I think Andy Haldane's talking about all the complexity that's been laid on top of this mm-hmm. by successive governments. And it has got more and more complicated. So there's limits on how much you can save each year into a pension in the annual allowance. There's the lifetime allowance, which is not a limit of how much you can save into a pension, but a limit on the total pension pot, which you then start to get heavy tax charges on top of. You then had some of the complications around the pension freedom stuff, although, again, that's not overly complicated. But what is complicated is working out, once you get that pot of money, what on earth you do with it in order to deliver that income. You've then got talk of the lifetime ISA, which is going to come in as a sort of rival to pensions. And then you've got talk that they might remove tax relief or they cut tax relief. Mm-hmm. Basically, they've become this kind of political football that's been messed around with. And in order to try and rein in the cost of them, which is short-term thinking in my book, extra little bits have been put in place to nab a bit of money back there, nab a bit of money back here. Do we need to nab a bit more money back in the future? So, yes, I would agree with him that they have been very, very complicated, but they have been made unnecessarily complicated. And if you stripped away all that artificial complication, a pension itself is very simple.
What are the dangers of all of this complication, of not understanding pensions? He reckons the problem's only going to become more acute in the future. What problems is he highlighting?
It's too complicated. You switch off and you don't do it, basically. I mean, to be fair, though, a lot of people are auto-enrolled into their pensions mm-hmm. nowadays. You know, it's the law. You have to
be auto-enrolled
in. Scams as well. Yeah, people trying to, you know, get in touch with you with investments that probably aren't that great. Why put an airport parking space in your pension? That's yeah. one of the recent ones. I'm not saying that's a scam. Those airport parking places might exist, but they're not really the best investment for most people, to be honest. You've got to be pretty rich before an airport parking space becomes part of your portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
And it should only be a small part of a diversified portfolio. It's become overly complicated. And so what he's saying is we're not making it easy enough for people to understand this. And what it's doing is switching people off, to which I would say, Mr. Osborne, stop launching new financial products and help to this and help to that. Just basically strip away all of those extra bits that you've layered on top of pensions and do this generation a favour, because they need a massive favour when they come to retire, because they're not going to get the pensions that their parents' generation got.
Worrying thing about this, before we get on to a question from a reader to your pensions agony uncle, is Andy Haldane's comments about financial advice. Conversations with countless experts and independent financial advisers have confirmed for me only one thing, that they have no clue either.
Again, I think that's I would say that's dramatic effect. I think that's completely unfair. I think there's lots of advisers out there and lots of financial experts who know plenty about pensions. I would question anyone who claims that they have some kind of edge that means they can mm-hmm. beat the market, or some form of scheme they've got that can beat the market. But there's plenty of people out there who will say to you, the best thing you can do with a pension is start saving early, save what you can and invest it, and do so, you know, if you don't want to take any risk, just invest it into the power of companies building up their profits and dividends over time in the widest possible global tracker fund. And if you do that for 30 or 40 years, you're putting yourself in the best possible position you can be in. And people who will tell you that advice are giving you good advice, so I don't think that we should talk them down.
So get advice, yes. Also, you can write into This Is Money as well, because you have Agony Uncle Steve Webb, former pensions minister, answering your questions. And this week, briefly, Simon, can I turn a £120 a month pension into cash to help pay off my mortgage? And what is Uncle Steve's answer?
Well, Uncle Steve has said, basically, depends what kind of pension this is that you've got. So this is a private pension, like either a work pension or something. It's not your state pension. You can't turn your state pension back into cash. If it's a defined benefit pension, where that company has agreed to pay you a sum of money for the rest of your life, then no, you can't. Under the old rules, you wouldn't have been able to do this with any kind of pension. But now, If you have a defined contribution pension that you've then bought an annuity with, there are some new rules coming into place, which means that you will basically be able to decide that your annuity is bad value and try and sell it back onto the sort of open marketplace, where people will then offer you a sum of money that they think reflects what they'll benefit from in terms of an investment from buying that income off you. Basically, they'll take the annuity and you get the sum of money, and then you might be able to do it.
Editor Simon Lambert.
On digital radio across the UK and online, this is Share Radio.
Now, is it worth changing career? We'll be exploring Britain's most in-demand jobs, but we got the latest unemployment figures out this week. The number in work hit a record high, according to the ONS. Jobless figure was down a smidge to 1.69 million between January and March. Here's Jim Hillage from the Institute of Employment Studies.
For the last couple of months, the growth in employment has started to tail off. Last month, actually, it fell a bit. This year, this month, it's just gone up a little bit. And there are various signs that you can see that things are beginning to start to level off, which is a bit of a concerning. But we have still got record levels of employment. So it's not all bad news, but it's worrying about what might be happening in the future. There's certainly the case that there's many more self-employed people now than there were a few years ago. And certainly quite a lot of the growth has been in self-employment, although that's been as much in full-time self-employment as part-time self-employment. And indeed, there have been a growth in full-time employed jobs as well. So self-employment growth is part of the picture. About three-quarters of the growth this month was due to a rise in self-employment as opposed to people in working for somebody else.
Well, subdued wage growth remains an issue. Average earnings up by just 2.1% in the year to January. We were also hearing this week job vacancies across the UK dropped by 9% in April, with the number of openings advertised falling by 12% this year, with areas such as financial services hardest hit. That's according to the job site Indeed. But despite this, there are industries where there are a lot of vacancies. We're hearing a real shortage in certain sectors, including engineering, nursing, teaching, with hundreds of thousands of jobs lying unfilled across the UK. So, Lee, is it time to change career? Where's the most in demand and where can you get the most money?
Well, it could well be. I mean, there is a shortage, massive shortage in certain areas. This week, I've tried to get a plumber and I've struggled to get a plumber all week. There is a shortage of plumbers. But what I'm trying to say is there's a lot of shortage of manual workers. And number one on this list that's been created by Adzuna is engineering. And I remember, either last year or the year before, speaking to a boss of one of the big manufacturers saying, it's a massive problem in the UK. We do not have enough skilled people, coming up and being educated or, taking the right qualifications in engineering. And actually, James Dyson, he's one of the most, influential inventors in the world, saying that there's a shortfall of, 1.8 million engineers across the UK. That's some stats from the Royal Academy of Engineering.
So he said we're heading for economic suicide.
Well, we don't have enough people to build stuff. And, if we're an innovative country, we've got all these creative types designing, products and certain things, and then we can't build them, then it's no good, being able to do these. But it's a good list. Number two, actually, is a nurse. That could be a symptom of all this, junior doctor stuff and people moving abroad because they're worried what are going to be the future consequences to all of
also
that.
Also, scrapping of the bursary scheme as well. That might impact.
Some other interesting things in there. Teachers. I mean, teachers, number six on the list. I remember a few years ago, I had a friend that wanted to train as a teacher, and they were saying that he couldn't go through and do the qualifications because they had too many teachers. Now it seems to be, reversed. Number eight is something I've always quite fancied. Yeah. Chef. I like to watch a bit of MasterChef. I reckon I could be a good chef.
Which is a really interesting one because it leads us into our next story, which talks about the changing high street.
Mm-hmm.
And it does go to show that we do rather like going out to restaurants now. So it's unsurprising there's a little bit of a shortage of chefs.
It's notoriously bad paid and you get treated pretty badly when you first start out. So I hear.
Hot and sweaty as well, I hear as well. It's not really one for me. But coming up, fancy a latte with your pint. Wetherspoons enters the takeaway hot drinks market because that is, of course, what Britain needs, more caffeine. No, I'm not joking. Coffee shops have actually increased 20-fold, up from just 215 in 1998 to over 4,200 last year. Now, This Is Money has been looking at how the 21st century has transformed the British high street. So, Simon, what else is in what has been kicked to the high street curb?
Well, coffee shop chains, they're on the up. Restaurant chains, they're on the up.
Anything we don't know, Simon?
Juice and smoothie chains, they're on the up. And fast food and takeaway chains, they are also on the up. I have this vision of a Britain of the future,
yeah,
where basically our economy consists of people drinking buckets of milk masquerading as coffee whilst either ordering food via Deliveroo or delivering food via Deliveroo and occasionally getting an Uber somewhere. Mm. And that's probably all we're going to do, basically. This sort of crazy service economy that just goes round in circles.
But so you see that. The number of clothing chains saw a 47% growth since 1998. No wonder, therefore, that we're seeing some that aren't keeping up fall massively by the wayside.
Yeah, I know. It's interesting, isn't it? Because you'd think there'd almost be a drop in that, wouldn't you, with people buying stuff online. But, the rag trade, it's a great business. It's people get into it. And they can make a bit of money, and you set up a shop, you get some clothes in, you sell it. You do that Alan Sugar. What is it? Smell what sells. That's what he says on The Apprentice, isn't it? You smell what sells, you get more of it, you sell more of it, and then you can maybe get another shop and another shop and another shop. And if you can get on the right side of it, it's a great business, but there will be loads of people who've opened clothes shops and gone bust. Just like there will be loads of people who've opened coffee shops and restaurants and things like that. But these are like really sort of quick turnover businesses. It's undeniable. The high street has changed substantially, hasn't it?
It has indeed. So what about Wetherspoons then? They're getting involved in the takeaway coffee market. But do we need more places to get our caffeine kick? Well, at 99p a cup, they might actually have some success here. But before we get started in that, though, our reporter Frey Lindsay has been digging around for a few interesting facts about the behemoth pub chain.
So there are a number of interesting things about Wetherspoons, most notably, and in regards to this conversation. Wetherspoons serving coffee might be a fun novelty, but they've been opening for breakfast for over 10 years at this point. All Wetherspoons open by 7 a.m. at the latest. Also of note, Tim Martin, the owner of the Wetherspoons chain, is worth apparently £750 million, so his business model clearly is working. Most interesting to me was, I didn't know this, there is no J.D. Wetherspoon. Apparently the name Wetherspoon comes from Tim Martin's old geography teacher, who said that he would never amount to anything. And Mr. Wetherspoons was a teetotaler. The J.D. apparently comes from a character from Dukes of Hazzard. The title for Wetherspoon's biggest fan has to go to a woman called Mags Thompson. She's apparently visited 936 Wetherspoons, according to BuzzFeed, and she plans to eventually visit all of them. She got started, it seems, because she got bored of waiting for her husband, who's a railway enthusiast. But most interestingly is that even though there are almost 1,000 Wetherspoons, supposedly each one has its own distinctive carpet design. Now, you don't have to take my word for that. Anyone who wants to check this could go look at wetherspoonscarpets.tumblr.com and see them all for themselves.
There you go, carpets, Lee. Not just C&A carpets, Wetherspoons carpets blog. There we go, there were some fun facts about Wetherspoons. What do you reckon to them getting involved in the takeaway coffee?
Well, I think that coffee shops have become kind of like the new bars. If you go out in central London now, I see quite a lot of people sort of 8, 9 o'clock, these coffee bars are still open and people are getting a little bit continental, I think. Mm. It's sitting outside or sitting in the window if it's a damp day in London, sipping their coffees. And I think bars have struggled a little bit to keep up. And what Wetherspoons does very well is that it manages to sort of, get onto these trends, and it kind of sees that coffees have become a massive thing, as breakfast had done 10 years ago. So that's why they sort of introduced them. And if they're going to sell them for 99p, it kind of makes sense that you can go in and take one away. Whether swathes of people are happy to go in before they, before they go into their office at 8 a.m. whipping into a Wetherspoons. Imagine your boss in, you're going to Wetherspoons. Oh yeah, I'm just getting a coffee. I mean, that is actually where it could fall down slightly, but I've got no doubt it'll be successful.
Simon, your views?
Quick Wetherspoons funny story. Yep. The Wetherspoons around the corner from me on Stroud Green Road, the White Lion of Mortimer, recently they sold it, it shut down. and a new pub has opened up there, independent pub called The White Lion. It's basically been gastrated. It's got a lot more expensive. But they've put a sign up outside, I noticed the other day, that said, "We are not a new Wetherspoons concept. This is your new local independent pub." So they've obviously decided people aren't going in there because they think Wetherspoons has pulled a Harrison Hall and has basically introduced a new upmarket concept. It's not Wetherspoons, people. Go in there. It's quite good.
And this is Simon Lambert, Consumer Affairs Editor, Lee Boyce. Thank you so much for joining us.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I, looking after the nation's savings for over 150 years.